first, our next guest is a former federal prosecutor who says at one point in his career, he didn't think innocent people were sent to prison in this country.
But while teaching a law class in 2001, he was asked to supervise the Kentucky Innocence Project, which led to an epiphany of sorts.
When his students uncovered DNA evidence that led to the reversal of a conviction, he took another look at the way crime investigations and prosecutions can put the wrong people behind bars.
Mark Godsey is a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati and the author of the new book Blind Injustice: A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. He's also the director of the Ohio Innocence Project. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you were a former federal prosecutor. Tell us about this case that started to change your mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, I came into the job, you know, a prosecutor's prosecutor. I'd been tough on crime. I'd been award-winning. You know, I was a prosecutor in New York City and just had that mentality and was very actually proud of it, being very tough on crime and all that kind of stuff. And so I went to a different school that had an innocence project already in existence. The professor who ran it was on sabbatical, so they asked me to supervise, and I really couldn't say no as the new professor on the block. And I remember going into the first meeting with the students, and they were going on and on about this prisoner that they thought was innocent named Herman May. And I asked about the case, and they told me how he got convicted. And I just sort of did a big eye roll and was just like, oh, yeah, right, this guy's totally guilty, and sort of wrote them off as these bleeding heart law students. And then DNA came back and proved him innocent. He was released. And, you know, just a few weeks earlier, I'd been scoffing at the stories of how he was a high school senior and the police had come and yanked him out of his social studies class, taken him down to the police station and plucked pubic hairs from his groin. And he stayed in the jail cell throwing up all night. You know, I'd just been like, yeah, he deserved it. And 'cause he's a rapist, but I was wrong. And so I sort of went through this, starting with that, this conversion where I sort of made it my business to try to understand how this happened. And then ultimately founded my own Innocence Project in Ohio. We've now freed 25 people who together served 470 years in prison for crimes they didn't commit. So I thought, you know, the transition I went through helps me understand the mentality of the prosecutors and how this happens. And so I wanted to write about it.
And let's get into that mentality. You say in many cases, maybe most cases of wrongful conviction, it wasn't that there was a bad actor operating in bad faith, whether a prosecutor or a police officer, but there are a lot of psychological assumptions and mindsets involved. Can you talk about kind of the baseline of that mindset that says, I know who's guilty, now we're going to prove it?
Yeah, I'll start off by talking about how they react in these post-conviction cases. And that was the first thing. Once I started doing innocence work, you know, we had several cases where the DNA clearly proved the person innocent. And we went to court and the prosecutors like fought back, you know, and I sort of thought, well, the evidence is clear. They're going to let the guy go. And they would come up with these ridiculous theories that just didn't make any sense and argue them with passion to try to say the guy's still guilty. And, you know, I talk about that in chapter two, and it's really just a form of denial. I mean, I think it's not that, you know, there's an evil person saying I'm going to keep an innocent person in prison, but most of these prosecutors and police are going into this for the right reasons, and it's part of their psyche and identity that they're the good guys and they're protecting society. And it's very hard after, you know, 20 years for somebody to come back and say you ruined somebody's life and you put an innocent person in prison. It's just sort of human nature. Cognitive dissonance kicks in. I talk about that quite a bit. Administrative evil, where you're sort of, that's a phenomenon where you're in a bureaucracy and you're just sort of going through the motions, and after a while, you're just following the routines of the organization. You don't really check your morality in the same way that you would if you were acting alone. So all these sort of things combine to sort of blind people. That's why I call it blind injustice, where they just start going through the motions instead of like looking at the humanity of each case. And so that, you know, that plays out in actual prosecutions now. I mean, prosecutors and police dehumanize the people that are charged. You know, they look at them as sort of deserving, as I did. They don't really stop and think about each case on an individual basis. It becomes very cookie cutter and like an assembly line approach to these cases. You know, there's a lot of the judges and prosecutors in most states are elected, so it becomes very politicized, where everyone has to sort of be tough on crime and flex their muscles and show everybody else in the office how tough they are on crime if they want to, you know, rise up in the ranks. And so it becomes very difficult internally from an institutional level to be sort of a reasonable person who steps back and wants to show sympathy to criminal defendants sometimes. So that's part of it. But, you know, there's confirmation bias and tunnel vision. There's malleable memories. There's all sorts of different psychological phenomena that lead for these wrongful convictions. And many of the time, the prosecutors aren't aware of it.
Let's get into a couple of specifics you just mentioned, and memory is one of those. You write a lot about witness identification, which as a layperson seems pretty convincing. Oh, one person, the victim, or three eyewitnesses or whatever, were successfully able to identify this person as the criminal, which often has happened in cases where we later found out, maybe because of DNA, that it wasn't them at all. What goes wrong with eyewitness identifications?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be the case, and I mean, to some degree, still maybe today, that if a witness takes a stand and says, I saw the crime happen, you know, I was the victim, I got a good look at the person's face, and I'm 100% certain that that's the guy who did it, and points at the defendant in the chair, that everyone sort of thinks, well, wow, you know, how could they possibly be wrong? That person's really confident. They would know they were there, and that's sort of the end of the case. Because of all these wrongful convictions and how they've been studied, you know, we've identified more than 2,000 in the past 25 years. We know that mistaken eyewitness identification is the leading cause of wrongful conviction, and it's caused sort of renewed interest in studying human memory. And I talk about this in Chapter 5 of Blind Injustice. It's fascinating when you really get into it how we have such a misconception in the public about human memory. In reality, our human memories, you know, many think of them as like a hard drive or a video recorder, and sort of you take down what you see and hear, and then later you hit the play button, you play it back. But in reality, our memories are more like quicksand. I mean, they're constantly sort of changing and shifting underneath us. They're much like Wikipedia, where we edit them and other people can edit them. And we're not even aware when, you know, somebody through suggestion, like a police officer, has asked some pointed questions that sort of change what we might think. And then all of a sudden our memory changes. And so it's a really fascinating thing to explore, as I do in Chapter 5. And, you know, I talk about how when I was a prosecutor, we played on that all the time. I mean, you'd have a case where you're convinced that the murder happened or the crime happened at 11 o'clock at night, and a witness comes in and says, well, he was still in the bar. The defendant was still in the bar at 11 o'clock. And what happens? Well, the police and the prosecutors sort of start cross-examining him there in the interview room and saying, are you sure? Because, you know, other witnesses are telling us different and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, like, you sort of test their memory, and it's not uncommon that you sort of bend a witness. They'll end up changing. You know, the more I think about it, you know, I think the game was still on. And by the time that person testifies at trial, they may fully believe what we call is now synthesized testimony. It's been sort of altered by the questioning of the police and prosecutors. And they may firmly believe the altered testimony, but that's not what they originally said. And it's more troubling, as what happened in my office, when sometimes the prosecutors and the police don't write down the original statement. When a witness gives information that's helpful to the defendant, like, you know, he was in the bar at the time of the murder. That's very helpful. They're supposed to write that down and turn it over. It's called Brady material after a U.S. Supreme Court case. They're supposed to give it to the defense pre-trial, so the defense is aware of it. But that doesn't always happen, unfortunately.
We're talking to Mark Godsey, author of the new book, Blind Injustice, A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. Let's talk a little bit about forensic evidence, Mark. I think for a generation raised on CSI and other shows, we're really convinced by what looks like objective scientific evidence that connects a suspect to a crime. Where can that go wrong?
Yeah, there's such a disconnect there because of all these CSI shows where, you know, the public thinks this forensic science stuff is akin to putting man on the moon. You know, it's these miracles that are happening. And in reality, we've got serious problems with forensics in this country. They're often unreliable. They're often overstated by forensic experts in court. And it is also, you know, bad forensic testimony is also a leading cause of wrongful conviction. You know, it's a couple of different things going on. Many of these forensic disciplines have never been sort of vetted under the scientific method. So they're themselves just sort of unreliable. You know, I've got a case where the person who committed the murder used a crowbar to break open a cigarette machine. Remember how cigarette machines used to always be in bars and they would be full of quarters? And back when this crime happened, after they murdered the people in the bar, the perpetrator broke open the cigarette machine with a crowbar. And he was convicted because the forensic expert testified that the crowbar found in the defendant's house, to the exclusion of every other crowbar in the world, is the one that made the scratches on the cigarette machine. But there's actually no sort of method by which you can say that. It's a great exaggeration. That's a perfect example. There's also some really interesting psychological studies going on about the extent to which confirmation bias taints outcomes. I mean, there's a guy named N.T.L. Dror, a psychologist out of London, who did an experiment where he went to some of the leading experts, fingerprint experts in the world, and said, you know, I want you to do something for me. We've got a case where a fingerprint expert testified years ago that the defendant's fingerprint was found at the crime scene, and that caused him to get convicted. But we now know from DNA evidence that the guy's innocent, so the fingerprint expert made a mistake. What we want you to do is look at the two fingerprints that was called a match at trial many years ago and tell us where this forensic expert went wrong. Tell us where the discrepancies are between the two fingerprints. What each fingerprint expert didn't know is that they were actually given a fingerprint set from their own case files that they had called a match in court years before. So they thought they were looking at one where it was a known mistake, but it was actually one where they caused somebody to get convicted. But this time they're told beforehand not to expect a match, and Etiel Drouhar got 80% of the fingerprint experts to flip their answer and say, yeah, there's not a match here. These are not the same.
And we'll leave it there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's Mark Godsey. His new book is called Blind Justice, A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. He's a law professor at the University of Cincinnati and the director of the Ohio Innocence Project. You can share your thoughts and experiences. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message on the Ideas Network Facebook page.